I think we're going to start.
Yeah.
Everybody here. Good evening to everybody. I'm going to put us on a temporary mute. Please feel free to unmute yourself as you are to kind of join in the conversation. I think I mentioned to you once before that if you're on a computer, the easiest way to unmute is to actually hold the space bar down. Kind of gives a temporary unmute, and then you let go and it's muted again. So it's kind of just easier than navigating Control Alt A, Control A's, clicking with the mouse, etc. It's just a simple press of the space bar. So
it worked.
Say that again.
It works.
Yes, it works. It works. It takes a second for it to kind of click, but yes, it does work. All right. So we are okay. Share screen. Where's my share screen? All right. Can everybody see the screen now? We're good. I'm just going to move that over here. I'm going to move this over here. It's got to be arranged the windows on my computer so I can see everything. Okay. So we spent a good deal of time focusing on the first part of Perek Zayin, which was the request to build the Beit HaMikdash, the refusal, the denial, Natan's first comments, then God's change of heart, and the nevuah of Natan. We spent a back and forth over the last six or seven shiurim addressing this first part of the parak, and more or less coming to the to this final statement: "K'chol adrim eileu, k'chol achizion azeh, kein diber Natan el David." That all, according to all of these things, this vision, Natan spoke to David. Sorry, I lost the place there for a second. There we go. And the basic conclusion that we saw, besides the timeline issue, which I think is an important piece, but kind of a separate piece, the basic conclusion was that David had desired in his whole life to build the Mikdash. He saw the opportunity in the conquest of Yerushalayim, in the centrality of Yerushalayim. The time had come to build the Mikdash. God had agreed and acknowledged that. We started to move the Aron to Yerushalayim in anticipation of building the Beit HaMikdash. And then, of course, it gets derailed with the conflict with Michal. The Nevuah here basically says to David, you are not going to build the Beit HaMikdash, whether an initial request denied or not. That is not going to happen. Instead, it's going to get delayed by a generation. And instead of you building the Mikdash, it's going to have to fall to your heir. That's one message of this Nevuah. The second message of this Nevuah, which in a sense is almost tangential and unrelated, but in its scope and significance, maybe even more far-reaching, is that not only is David's son going to build the Mikdash, but this son, who is yet to be named and identified, really yet to be born, is going to begin a dynasty of kings that will be attributed to the house of David, and this dynasty is going to endure. And the same way David wanted to build a house for God, an eternal house, a Beit Olamim, God says to David, instead, I'm going to build you a house, and your house is the one that is going to be eternal. I will affix and establish your house for eternity, your throne, your kingdom. Time and time again in this parak, God says to David, this promise that you're going to have an heir to the throne, your kingdom, will be eternal. We spend some time discussing the question that raises. It raises both a practical question as well as a textual one. Is, in fact, his kingdom eternal? What about all the years and the periods of exile? And, of course, we gave various answers, but it does not take away from the magnitude of the promise. The magnitude of the promise to David is that this is going to be an eternal kingdom, chazdil yasum imenu, unlike for Shaul, who sinned, they took it away from him. Your son will be for me like my own son. I may have to punish your descendants at some future time, but the promise to David is eternal. The message is really an extraordinary one, and one that turns the entire perek on its head. Because whereas initially the perek was about building the Beit HaMikdash, the technicalities of whether David could or couldn't build the Mikdash, that may have been the initial stage of the perek, the subject shifts very quickly to the notion that David HaMelech is going to have a dynasty that is going to be literally messianic in its scope, eternal, all the way to Yemot HaMashiach. The whole notion of Melech HaMashiach comes from this idea that the promise to the house of David is an eternal one, and when the restoration of Malchus will eventually come about, it will continue or reconstitute the kingdom of David HaMelech. David is transformed in this parak from a historical figure to a symbol of the eternal relationship between God and Israel and the eternity of the Jewish people. It's really an extraordinary moment. The Nevuah starts by saying to David, your life's ambition has just been dashed, but we're going to turn it into another life's ambition. We're going to turn it around. And we're going to tell you that now, as much as you might be disappointed that you're not going to build the Mikdash, we're going to create for you a dynasty that will endure forever, far greater than David had ever anticipated. And that's more or less where this parak ends, or the Nevuah of Natan ends. What remains for us to look at now is the second half, or the last piece of this parak, which is how David reacts to this promise. And David's reaction is no less extraordinary, and maybe to an extent demonstrative of what it is that made David so special to the point of deserving this promise. If you think about it, God has never made such a promise to anyone before, nor will he do so again. It's just in the middle of a simple request to build a Mikdash, God says to him, no, but we're going to transform you into the symbol of Jewish history. It's really quite an extraordinary response. And so what I want to start looking at this evening is David's response, or tefillah in tefillat hodayah, and his prayer of thanksgiving, and gratitude in response to this promise. So asking ourselves the question, how did David react to this nevuah, was two possibilities. On the one hand, he could react negatively, be very disappointed. Here he was, whole his life ambition to build the Mikdash, and he's just been told no. Or he could react to this very unique promise that he will have a kingdom for descendants on his throne and the building of the dynasty of Jewish history. So we're going to read the parak. The parak appears in two places. It appears here in Shmuel Bet Parak Zion, and virtually the same tefillah, with slightly different language, appears in Divrei Hayamim, Perek Yud Zayin, starting with Pasuk Tet Zayin. I'll just show you how it begins. In Shmuel Bet, sorry, that's not what I wanted. In Shmuel Bet, Vayavod David Vayeshev Lifnei Hashem. Ma'amelach David comes and he sat before God, Vayomer, and he began, Mi Anochi Hashem Elokim, etc. And it's exactly how the beginning of Divrei Hayamim, Vayavod Hamelach David, Vayeshev Lifnei Hashem, Vayomer, Mi Ani Hashem Elokim, Mi Beiti, etc. So these two prakim are parallel. I mentioned that at the outset because we're going to compare a few items here in a few minutes. Okay, so our mission, our job for this evening, and probably part of next week, is to analyze this tefillah of David HaMelech. Vayavo HaMelech David, Vayeshev Lifnei Hashem. David came, and he sat before God. So what does it mean to sit before God? Let's start from that phrase, Vayeshev Lifnei Hashem. So actually, what I've done for tonight is on the tabs on top of this page, there's the source page, which I'll post on the internet at the end of our shiur, on the website. Everything I'll show you tonight is here. And I've the Perek in Divrei Hayamim, and then the Mikvaot Gedolot, the Mefarshim on this Perek. What is Vayeshev? Sorry, that's the wrong pasuk. Let's do this again. I'm trying to navigate. Okay. Vayavo HaMelech David Vayeshev Lifnei Hashem. So what does Vayeshev Lifnei Hashem mean? He sat before God. Why is that significant? So in Chumash, the phrase Lifnei Hashem, before God, has a very specific connotation. We can describe it in general terms, to engage with the Navi, to engage in Tefillah, to sit before God, to stand in the presence of God, Amida Lifnei Hashem, in terms of Tefillah. But the phrase Lifnei Hashem in Chumash has a very specific connotation, and it usually refers to something related to the Shekhinah, the Mikdash, or in this case, the Kodesh HaKadosh. The Lifnei Hashem is usually a reference to the inner sanctum of the Holy of Holies, where the Aron sits. And so Rashi comments, Vayeshev Lifnei Hashem, meaning Lifnei HaAron. He literally walked into the tent he had pitched that had the ark in order to express his tefillah. Right? Here the ark really was the symbol of the whole perek. On the one hand, he wanted to bring the Aron to Yerushalayim, and he did, amidst great tragedy and challenge. Then he wanted to build the Mikdash around it, and he was told no. So now the Aron is going to sit in this tent for a generation. So the Aron becomes the conduit for his tefillah. Vayeshev Lifnei Hashem, he goes and he sits before the Aron and pours out his heart in tefillah. I will make one observation, and that is the Radak points out to Lifnei Aron, Mikan samchu rabbeinu zal she'ein yeshiva ba'azara ela l'malchei Beit David. There's a Gemara that says that there's a halacha in the Beit HaMikdash that you're not allowed to stand, you're not allowed to sit in the courtyard of the Mikdash. You're not allowed to sit in the Mikdash. Why not? Because it's the place of the Shekhinah. You can't conduct yourself in a casual fashion when you're in the place of the Shekhinah. So you can't just walk into the Beit HaMikdash, pull up a chair, and sit down. It doesn't function that way, right? It's like, I use the analogy of the outdoor minyanim today. You know, everybody grabs a chair and sits down in an outdoor minyan. Okay, the Beit HaMikdash is not an outdoor minyan. It's the Beit HaMikdash. And you don't just pull up a chair, sit down, and cross your legs and relax. Right? So you have to stand in the azara of the Beit HaMikdash. You have to stand in the reverence of the place. The only ones who were allowed to ever sit in the courtyard of the Mikdash were kings, and specifically Malchei Beit David, the kings of the house of David. And that's partially because the people stood before the king was able to sit, and there were times when the king was required to sit. There's a famous mitzvah of Hakel, where the king would sit and read the Torah, and everybody would stand in the courtyard. Nonetheless, this halacha of Ein Yeshiva Ba'azara Ela L'Malchei Beit David, the exception, of course, the house of David. David comes and he sits before the Aron. So, in a sense, David has already conducted himself in the context of a Kohen Gadol. When he was moving the Aron, he was dressed in the garments of the Kohen Gadol. He was dancing, like he was entering into the Lifnei Hashem of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. He has the sort of that closeness to God. And so it says that David went and he sat Lifnei Hashem, he sat before the ark. So that's just kind of a reference to the context of this tefillah. And what is he saying in this tefillah? We're going to read it through. I want to read through the whole parak, just to get an impression.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
Is Vayeshev, doesn't that sometimes mean dwell, or it's definitely not?
Not here. Not here. It can, but it depends on its context. But it's a borrowed phrase from to sit. To sit permanently is to dwell. Here it's the actual word. Comes from the root, the shorash, shinva bet.
Okay,
so I want to read through the whole, it might actually be yud shin bet. is the Shavish. I want to read through the whole parak, and then we'll come back to these psukim one by one. But I want to get an impression of the whole story. So here's his tefillah, Vayomer. Mi anochi Hashem Elokim, umi veiti ki haviotani, ad halom. Who am I? Who is my household that, or my house, that you have brought me to this place? Vatiktan od zot be'enecha Hashem Elokim. And yet this was yet a small thing. In other words, not only is this that I am nothing, I am a nobody, and my house is nothing, and you've done this greatness for me, you brought me to this place in my life, but even so, even this would not be enough, but even more so, v'tadaber gam el beit avdecha l'merachok, you have spoken of your servant's house for a great distance. V'zot torat ha'adam Hashem Elokim. This too is the manner of man. Torat ha'adam, the law of man. Hashem. Ma yosif David oto deber elecha. What can David add, say more? V'yata yadata tavdecha Hashem Elokim. You know your servant, O God. Bavur devarcha ochelibcha asita et kol ha'gdula zot. For your word and for your, according to your own heart, your desire, you have done this greatness, l'odiyat avdecha, to make your servant know it. Akein gadalta Hashem Elokim, therefore you, God, are great. Ein kamocha ve'ein Elokim zelatecha, there is none like you, there is no other God besides you. V'chol esher shemanu ba'ozneinu, according to all that we have heard with our ears. Mi ke'amcha Yisrael goy echad ba'aretz, who is like your people Israel, one nation in the land. Asher halchu Elohim liftot lo la'am v'lasum lo shem v'lasot lachem hagdula v'noraot le'artzecha mipnei amcha asher padit lacha mimitzrayim goyim ve'elokav. I'm not even sure I can translate this pasuk because it is so grammatically inconsistent and difficult to understand that I could translate words, but it wouldn't help us comprehend it. Whom gods went and redeemed him for as a people, redeemed them as a people for them, for him, to make a great name for you, for your people, who you redeemed from Egypt, nations and gods. That's a chunk that needs to be sorted out. So we're going to leave that one. V'tuchonen l'cha amcha Yisrael, you've established for your people Israel, L'cha la'am adolam, you've made them your people for eternity. V'ata Hashem ayita lahem l'lokim, and you, God, became their God. V'ata Hashem l'lokim adabar shedibarta l'avdecha ve'al beito hakem adolam. And now, God, that which you have spoken to your servant, to his household, establish for eternity. V'asei kasher dibarta, and do as you have spoken. Let your name be glorified, be magnified for eternity, saying, Hashem Tzvaot Elohim Yisrael, God of hosts over Israel, uveit avdecha David yenachon lefanecha. Your servant David's house shall be established before you. Ki ata Hashem Tzvaot Elokei Yisrael, you God of hosts, God of Israel, gilit et ozen avdecha lemor, you have revealed to your servant, to his ear, saying, "Bayit evnelach, I'll build you a house." Al kein matzav dechat libolit palel lechat tefila zot. Therefore, your servant has found it necessary to pray this prayer. Ata Hashem Elokim, ata u Elokim udvarcha yu emet. You, therefore, now God, you God alone, you are truth. Your word is truth. V'tadaber al avdecha tatava zot. You have promised this good thing to your servant. Now, bless the house of your servant to be eternal before you. For you, God, have spoken. And for your blessing, let the house of your servant be blessed forever. Okay, That is a beautiful tefillah that has that is very difficult to understand. The psukim here, phrases here that just the syntax, the grammar, the structure, the incoherentness of it is something which needs to be addressed. But bigadol, if we look at the whole picture, what's the basic theme of this tefillah? You have to summarize it in, without understanding every nuance of every pasuk, just the basic cadence, what's the takeaway? What's he thanking God for? Basic core message. Let's start with that. What do you think? What seems to be the focus? What message has he continuously come back to throughout this tefillah?
Sort of, who am I that you've done all this for me and for my house, for my future generations?
Well, that's how he starts. Who am I that you've done all this? That's his opening pasuk. But the bulk of it is not about who am I. The bulk of it is, I would say, the first pasuk is who am I. The rest of it is who are you. Right? The rest of it is the greatness of God, who has promised him a house, promised him a kingdom, promised him generations, promised him, right, your name shall be great, you redeemed Israel out of Egypt, you were their God, you made them their people, you've made this promise to me, let your promise be fulfilled. Right? The bulk of it is about the promise to David that his children will be on the throne, that he'll have a throne for eternity. The bulk of it is an expression of, it starts with an expression of humility, right? As Jackie said, me, who am I, mi anochi? But it shifts very quickly to this sense of the grandiose nature of this promise. Yigdal shimcha adolam lemor, God, you have, your name should be magnified for eternity. Because you said, Beit avdecha yeh nachon lefanecha, that the house of your servant will be eternal before you. And that phrase, if we carried through the phrase nachon or le'olam, the Beit Avdecha, the house of your servant, le'olam, berechet Beit Avdecha, v'tedaber al Avdecha t'tovazot, but this constant theme about how this nature of this promise that he has made to David, that his children shall be an eternal kingship. So of the various pieces of this perek that we've seen from the beginning, the one that picks up, that David picks up in his tefillah, is not the question of building the Mikdash. That's not in this tefillah at all. Never once does he even mention the Mikdash. It's not about Michal, and it's not about his experience with the Aron. It's not about any of that. He has one singular focus, which is the promise of Davidic dynasty, which really is appropriate, right? That's the one piece that he should pick up on, because that was the promise to him. And so in a very moving way, he realizes the extraordinary journey that he's taken and the significance, the uniqueness of this promise for him and his household. So let's start from the beginning again and take it phrase by phrase. Pasuk Yirchat. Mi anochi Hashem Elokim umi beti ki eviotani ad halom. Who am I and who is my house, mi beti, that you have brought me thus far? So there's two references here that are important. First of all, it's not only mi anochi, it's also mi beti. The promise to David wasn't about David, it was about the bayit of David. It was about the dynasty, it was about the household, it was about the future. So David, in this expression of humility at the beginning of this perek, comes back to the bayit, but in this case, the bayit backwards, meaning not where he's going to be, but where he has come from. Not the bayit he's going to build, but the bayit that he emerges from. who am I and who is my house that you have brought me from that moment, from that place, to thus far, ad halom. Now, the Mefarshim are split over what is David's humility an expression of or about. One possible simple explanation is, show you in the in Rashi. Rashi says, "What is Mi Anochi Hashem ki veiti ki vitani ad olam? Who am I that you brought me to this place?" Says Rashi, "Minave roim vitani lemachut. You brought me from a shepherd of sheep, from a shepherd of a flock. You have brought me to this place of kingship." Right? So if you look at the parak earlier, one of the things that Natan had made reference to was Komar Hashem, Kotamala Dila David, Komar Hashem, Ani lekachticha min hanaveh. I took you from amongst the sheep. I took you from the flock. Me'achar atzon. Liot nagid ala mi Yisrael. That's how Natan's nevuah started. I took you, I created you from a simple shepherd. I've transformed you through my divine providence and your skill. I've transformed you. You are now the king of Israel. So that's exactly what David is responding to. Mi anochi, mi beti, who am I? I was a nothing. I was a shepherd. In a simple little house of Beit Yishai in Beit Lechem, I had no stature. And you transformed me into the king of Israel, promised a dynasty for generations to come. That's one part of it. On the other hand, Radak points out something, Mitzvah David actually, points out something else, which is that there's a second theme running through the history of David, that this sentiment of humility always comes back to, and that's Halomiruta Moavia Anuchiba Aniba. This story about Megillat Rut, about Rut and Boaz, always comes back to, in a sense, to haunt David. He always has this sense that, is he really worthy? Is he really that significant? Is he really? Come back to the story of Megillat Rut and the question of Rut's lineage from Moab and the Torah's prohibition against accepting converts from Moab and the exception that was made because of Rut, right? The Torah's prohibition against accepting converts from Moab was because Moab, al dvar shelo kidmu atchem b'lechem uvamayim, because Moabites were me, they were like the continuation of Sodom. They refused to come out and greet you when you left Egypt. They to bring you provisions. They acted like Sodom, their great-great-great-grandfather, Lot, who was married to, and his daughters were born in Sodom, Lot, who had emerged from the devastation of Sodom, and the daughters, in this union of Lot and his daughters, created Ammon and Moab as a continuation of the legacy of Sodom. We talked about at length when we studied Megillat Rut. That story, right, in contrast to the chesed, the kindness, the consideration, the devotion, the mesirut nefesh, which was Rut, and the conflict over her status that permeates the story of Megillat Rut itself, you see it pop up in the story of David. We spent some time looking at it when we looked at David's first introduction to Shaul, Ben Miza and Na'a. So there's always this hint that David's humility is driven not just by the fact that he started as a shepherd, but that there's always this cloud. This critics love to point to this cloud of David's head, that he came from Mutamovia. Maybe he's not so legitimate. Maybe he's not such an acceptable king or acceptable person. So that may be driving a little bit of this extraordinary reference. Mi Anochi, who am I? I was a shepherd. But Mi Beiti, I come from the lineage of Ruth and Boaz, and yet I have been transformed into this moment. V'tiktan odzot be'enecha Hashem Elokim, v'tedber gam et beit avdecha l'merachok. not only am I emerged to become king, but now you speak to me of the great Rachok, the future. Rachok, Radak says it means the past, but the pshat of Merachok is that it means the future. Gam Bet Avdecha Merachok. I think we talked about the biblical frame of reference of time. We talked about this idea that in Tanakh terms, the word for the future is Acharit Hayamim, Achor. The word for the past is Lefanim BeYisrael. Lefanim means that which is in front of me. And la'achor is that which is behind me. Because unlike in English, where we talk about our past being behind us and our future in front of us, in biblical terms, it's the other way around. Our future is behind us, and our past is in front of us. Because we live with 20/20 hindsight. We can see that which has already been. And so our past is in front of us, we can see it. Lefanim beYisrael is that which is in front of me, and the panim is the past. Whereas that which is not yet occurred, I can't see because that's behind me. I can't see behind me. Right? And therefore, it's the acharit hayamim, the future time. We walk through time backwards, literally. So, v'tedaber gam et avbet avdecha lemerachok. You're telling your servant that which will, in the distance, right? In the far distance, meaning the future. V'zot tarat ha'adam. That's a phrase, right? That's the first phrase we've encountered that really makes no sense. And this is the law of man. What does that mean? Zot Torat Adam. What does that phrase mean? He's talking about his humility and the sense of gratitude he has for God for giving him this vision of the future of his household for eternity, for generations to come. Zot Torat Adam. What does that phrase mean? And this is the manner of man? This is the law of man? So here again, the Mefarshim are split. Rashi makes the suggestion that it means bitmiya, right? It's a question. Is this ra'ulit baser? This is what is you're going to say to man? That you're going to inform him of the future? That am I worthy to see a glimpse of the future? Is that's what I'm worthy of? The Hadak, on the other hand, points to the fact that this perek has a parallel in Divrei Hayamim. And in Divrei Hayamim, we find the same psukim, but with a slightly more, a little bit of editing that sheds a great deal of light on the meaning of these psukim. And so if you look at the exact parallel pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, this is Divrei Hayamim, Mi ani Hashem Elokim u'mi veiti ki veitani ad olam v'tiktan zot be'enecha Elokim v'tidaber al beit avdecha lemerachok. Was this a small thing in your eyes, O God, to speak of your servant's future? U'reitani kitor ha'adam ha'ma'ala Hashem Elokim. And regard me in the manner of people of high degree, of high stature. Meaning, it's all part of the same expression of humility. Not only did you take me as a shepherd and transform me into a king, but you've given me a glimpse of the dynasty I'm going to have in the future, as if to speak to me and about me as if I'm one of the great, the people of high degree, of high pedigree, of high stature, kitor ha'adam ma'ala, as if I'm one of the great ones. I don't deserve that. And yet, ure'itani, you perceived me as if I am kitor ha'adam ma'ala, as if I am one of the great before Hashem God. And that's exactly the phrase here, v'zot torat ha'adam. It's a little more ambiguous in Sefer Shmuel. It gains a lot more depth in its parallel pasuk in Divrei Hayamim. That will be our recurring theme for this discussion. Okay. So for everybody with me? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Ma yosif David od ledaber elecha. What more can I add? Says David. V'ata yadata tavtecha Hashem Elokim. You know your servant. Meaning I have nothing more to add because you know who I am. Yadat ladat is also not only to know but also to choose. Like Abraham says, God says to Abraham, המחסה אני את אברהם את אשר אני עושה, כי ידעתיו למען אשר יצווה את בניו ואת ביתו אחריו ללכת לעשות צדקה ומשפט, לשמור דרך השם לעשות צדקה ומשפט. Before the destruction of Sodom, Hashem reveals to Avram what his intention is. And the pasuk says that God says to himself, Kaviyachol, that he's going to reveal to Avraham that which he's going to do, Ki yeda'ativ, for I've made known to him, or as some translated, I chose him for the purpose of guarding the way of Hashem and doing that which is just and right. Similarly, you know your servant, you've chosen your servant. This is an expression of Bechira. This greatness to choose David, to choose his household, to establish his dynasty, and to inform him of this greatness, is an extraordinary moment. Therefore, you are great God, none other, none beside you, none other like you. Which brings us to the core pasuk in this section, which is probably the least intelligible pasuk here, and that is pasuk Chaf Gimel. I say least intelligible because to make heads or tails out of it, the Radak offers four different possible interpretations. If one parshan offers four different possible interpretations of one pasuk, I think it's indicative of the challenge of understanding this verse. So let's see what's going on. Who is like you, O God, one people, like Israel, O God, one nation in the earth, on the earth? It's a phrase we actually quote quite often. Who can compare to your people Israel? So I'm going to work through this pasuk with a simple question. To whom is David speaking? And in what person, form of speech, is he speaking? Second or third person? To whom is he saying the words, Umi ki amcha Yisrael goyachad ba'aretz? That's a simple question. To whom is he speaking? Right? That should be a simple answer.
It would seem to be God, because he says, Amcha, your people.
Correct. Right? He's talking to God, and he refers to Israel as your people, which means he's speaking in second person or third person. Is he speaking to God or about God?
Second person.
Fine. Opening phrase, Amcha Yisrael goyachad ba'aretz, who is like you, your people, O God, one nation, Israel, in the earth, on the earth. He's speaking to God about Israel, second person. Fine. Next phrase. Asher hochu Elohim lifdot lo la'am v'lasum lo shem v'lasot lachem hagdula v'noraot le'artzecha mipnei amcha asher padita lecha mimitzrayim goyim ve'elokav. It's too long a phrase. Let's break it down. Asher hochu Elohim lifdot lo la'am v'lasum lo shem. Let's take it from here. Asher halchu Elohim liftot lo la'am b'lasum lo shem.
Becomes third person.
Right? So now suddenly he seems to be talking about God in third person. God went and redeemed them as his people. Halchu Elohim liftot lo la'am, to redeem for himself the people, and to make for himself a name by redeeming Israel from Egypt. Right? He'll come back to Egypt at the end. That seems to be a reference to God in the third person redeeming Israel for his people. Liot lo la'am. Halchu alim liftot lo la'am. Whom God went and redeemed Israel for him as a people. So we're still talking about God, but we went from second person to third person. Okay. Gets more complicated.
Can I ask? Sorry.
it gets more complicated, because typically if the word Elohim refers to God, even though it's a plural word, we typically conjugate the plural, the noun referring to God in the singular. When we refer to idolatry, we conjugate it in the plural. Lo yelcha Elohim acherim al panai. You shall not have other gods. But Bereshit bara Elohim. But God, Elohim referring to God, is always a singular. Because, of course, we don't believe in multiple deities. So what does it mean when it says Asher halchu Elohim? Halchu is a plural. Gods went and redeemed for himself. Right, it's a singular. Ivdot lo la'am. Singular. So why is it in the plural? So the Radak says, Lashon Kavod, the royal we. Only in this case, the royal they, right? The royal it became a they. The royal reference to God in the deity, in the covered of it, the magnitude of it, the majesty of it, conjugated in the plural. Says the Radak, happens. It's possible. Okay, but it's problematic. Rashi offers a different interpretation. Rashi says, very interesting, Rashi says, Halchu Elohim, the word Elohim doesn't always mean God. The word Elohim can also refer to power, judge. Stature, judge. Ad Elohim yavod dvash nehem. And in this case, says Rashi, Moshe v'Aaron. Because it says, in this week's parasha actually, Netaticha Elohim lefaro v'aron achicha yeneviecha. I will make you a master, power, authority to Paro, and Aaron will be your spokesperson. God says to Moshe, I will make you Elohim lefaro. So in that context, says Rashi, the phrase here means Halchu Moshe v'Aaron, his agents, his shlichim, Halchu Elohim, to redeem Israel out of Egypt to be God's people. But in that context, we're still talking in second person. Right? Who is like your people, God, Israel, whom agents, Shlichim, Moshe and Aaron, went to redeem them to be your people. Two possibilities. We either conjugated the deity of God in the plural because it's the royal we or the royal they, or it refers to Moshe and Aaron. And the complexities grow. And to do for you great and tremendous things in the land. Who's the you? So are we still talking to God? That Moshe and Aaron went and did great things for you? Or are we talking about Israel, and we're saying God is doing great things for you in the land. V'lasot lachem, you Israel, God has done gdula nora'ot, greatness and wonders in your land. Mipnei amcha asher patita lacha mimitzrayim, for your people whom you redeemed out of Egypt. Now we're back to second person. And then we end with two words which seem to be completely misplaced. Goyim ve'elokav. Nations and their gods. What is that about? How did this verse end with the phrase, nation? It's much more potent than the Hebrew, because you realize how it's just sort of dangling two words at the end of the sentence. I forget, the translations kind of try to interpret it already. But
maybe it's talking about me, oh me.
And maybe again, this is the ambiguity here is much more potent than the interpretation. That the fact that this pasuk is so unclear is really extraordinary. Who is like you, Israel? Who is like your people, Israel? One nation in the land, whom they, God's powers, went, redeemed him from, and did for you great things for your land because of your for your people who they redeemed from Egypt, nations and gods. Goyim ve'eloka. So I suggested, I told you that the Radak offers four possible interpretations to this phrase. Let's take a quick look at them. Goyim ve'elokav, interpretation number one, Perush. migoyim ume alakav umem mimitzrayim mishameshet b'mkom shnayim mushlasha. Says the Radak, this phrase, the mem in Mitzrayim, asher patita lecha mimitzrayim, you redeemed Israel out of Egypt, megoyim, out of nations, me'alav, and from their gods. It's all one phrase. You redeemed Israel out of Egypt, out of nations, out of their deities. Mimitzrayim, migoyim, u'me'alav. Option number one. Option number two. Operush veikita goyim be'alav, kemo shekatuv v'chol olam Mitzrayim eseh shvatim. Or maybe it means that there's a word missing. Your people whom you redeemed out of Egypt, and you smote, in so doing, you smote nations and their deities. Goyim velohav. It's very appropriate for this expression. Or maybe it doesn't refer to Mitzrayim at all. Or perish goyim Yisrael. Maybe this nations that we're talking about is not the whom you redeemed Israel from, but the you've but a synonym for Israel, meaning you redeemed Israel out of Egypt. Israel, which was a collection of nations, tribes, goyim, velokav, and their elahav, and their leaders, their zkenim, their elders. Right? You brought them all out of Egypt. Goyim, a family of tribes, of nations, together with their leaders, together with their zkenim v'gdulav. Or maybe it means, the famous medrash based on a pasuk in Yeshayahu, that God feels always the pain of Israel. And so when we redeemed Israel out of the slavery of Egypt, we also redeemed Kaviyachol, God, out of the slavery of Egypt. Asher padita lecha mimitzrayim, goyim, meaning Israel, ve'elokav, and God was similarly redeemed. If I have four psukim to interpret, or four interpretations to interpret the same two words, four very different variations of or themes, then what does it tell me about the pasuk? Usually that's a reflection of circumstances where I think the questions are better than the answers. Right? And the ambiguity stands. The ambiguity of this phrase is really extraordinary. So what do I do in this parak if I have a pasuk that's unintelligible?
Go to Divrei HaYamim and see what it says there.
Exactly. Says Rashi, just go to Divrei HaYamim and you'll see what it says. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to go to Divrei HaYamim and we're going to see that there it's a different pasuk. Umi kiamcha Yisrael goy echad ba'aretz. Who is like your people Israel, one nation in the earth? Asher halach ha'elohim, so first of all, you see that it's gotten rid of the plural. Asher halach ha'elohim, for God has gone, lifdot lo la'am, to redeem them for himself as his people, lasum lecha shem gdulot v'nara'ot, and to do for you great, wondrous things, mipnei amch, ligaresh, Mipnei amcha asher patita mimitzrayim goyim, to remove, expel nations before your people Israel, whom you redeemed to Egypt, remove from them, from before them, nations. When did God remove nations before Israel, whom he had redeemed from Egypt? To what is that referring? Driving out nations before your people, God, whom you had redeemed from Egypt?
Yes, all the wars that they fought, all the people that they fought, like Amalek and Yan, and all those people that they fought on the way out of Egypt.
On the way out of Egypt, or more in particular, or more particularly in the land of Israel. Right. In other words, in the migration, in the transition from Egypt, we've now shifted our attention. Who is like your people Israel? You redeemed them out of Egypt, you brought them to the land of Israel, and now you have enabled them to settle there by removing the populations of the Canaanites through, right, by driving out the Canaanites so that the land could be inhabited by the Israelites. Ligaresh mipnei amcha shepatita mimitzrayim goyim. So first of all, the word Elohav does not appear at the end of this pasuk. And second of all, there's an extra word here. Legaresh. So if I come back to our pasuk, if I add that word here, legaresh, what it means, it says exactly what it says. Lasot l'chashem glavino od le'aretzecha, to do wondrous things for your land, referring to the land of Israel. So we're shifted gears from Egypt to Israel, before your people whom you redeemed from Mitzrayim, legaresh, to drive away goyim belohav, nations and their deities, to create that idolatry-free zone in the land of Israel. And so the end of this pasuk shifts us from the attention in Mitzrayim to our attention in the conquest and settlement of the land of Israel, from Sefer Shmot to Sefer Yeshua and Shoftim. And there, in the land of Israel, where you've established the people, enable them to live, v'tuchonen lecha tamcha Yisrael lecha la'am ad olam. You've built and established this people who you've redeemed from Egypt, who you took out of Egypt, miki amcha Yisrael, and you have established them to be your people Israel for eternity. That brit is well known. That's established. That God has promised Israel we would be his people for God. We would be God's people forever. And you would be their God. Up until this point, this little Samach paragraph break here, everything he has spoken about is about what? These two psukim, Chavbet, Chav Gimel, Chav Dalet, who is like you, God? There is none like you. There is none all that you have done, and your people Israel. You took them out of Egypt. You brought them to the land. You drove out the nations. You settled them in the land, and you established a brit with them to be your people for eternity. Classic story of the Jewish people. But in a language which is, in a syntax, in a grammar, in a language which is chopped, jumpy, second person, third person, talking to Israel, talking to God, talking to, right? The ambiguity in these phrases is really quite extraordinary. We need Divrei Hayamim to sort it all out, to anchor us in its meaning. Why that's important, I'll show you momentarily. And then we come to the last part of this parak. The latter half is a little bit more cohesive in its message. Yata Hashem Elokim Adavar Shedibart Al Avdecha Be'al Beito Hakem Ad Olam. And now, God, the word, that promise that you have made to your servant about his house and his kingdom, to establish it for eternity, Aseh Kasher Dibarta. I ask that you do as you have spoken, and let your name be great for eternity. V'igdal Shimcha Ad Olam Le'mor Hashem Tzvot Elokim HaYisrael Uveit Avdecha David Yenachon Lefanecha, let your house of your servant be established forever. And that's the theme that he builds every pasuk now until the end. Bayit Evnelach, I'll build your house, therefore I pray to you. Your word should be true. You spoke to your servant, let this goodness come about. The blessing over your house, over your servant's household, let it be olam lefanecha, that it should be eternal. Would that be the case? Ki ata Hashem Elokim dibarto mibirchatcha yivarach beit avdecha liolam. So the latter psukim is a very consistent message, one of hodayav, thanksgiving for this promise, and the prayer, the tefillah, that God should keep this promise, right? David is sensitive to the fact that this is an extraordinary promise, unprecedented, that he'll have a throne last for eternity. Would that be the case? And so his tefillah is all about that extraordinary promise. And so we kind of left it across. We'll spend a little more time talking about these last psukim next week, but we're sort of left with this impression. If we read the parak as it reads in Divrei Hayamim, it's very straightforward. Much more straightforward than it is in Sefer Shmuel. It doesn't have the ambiguity, Mikamcha Yisrael, Shepatitim Mitzrayim Goyim. It doesn't have the plurals, Hashem Halach Elokim, instead of Hashem Halachu Elohim. It doesn't have the missing phrases. It's much more straightforward. Why is it so choppy in Shmuel? It could be that's just the way it was written, but I think that maybe there's something else there. It almost reads like a speech that was not proofread. Right? Almost reads like a speech that was not edited. Divayomim at the benefit of hindsight of close to 600 years. So over the course of time, it gets edited. The typos get removed.
Is there any other place in Sefer Shmuel where there's that kind of problem?
Yeah, many. And I'll show you. We'll talk about them next week. It's not only in Sefer Shmuel. I think it's a reflection of. It's not just that it was. You know, we all have different styles when we write than when we speak. That's characteristic of everybody. When we write, we sit, we write, we rewrite, we edit, and we recompose, and we check for typos, and we check for grammar, and sometimes our over-editing makes us, especially on the computer, sometimes we can over-edit, and then we end up with sentences that were a hybrid of two sentences that were there originally, and now we're put together, and now they're unintelligible because we over-edited. That happened to me on Erev Shabbos. Sent that adresha Erev Shabbos, and there was a sentence there that made no sense because it was a hybrid combination of two sentences that I had strung together and edited them. So it's kind of stuck in my mind. But generally speaking, when we write, we sit, we edit, we proofread, we have a different cadence, and we have a different language, and we have a different style. When we speak off the cuff. And we use sentence structures sometimes that don't make sense because we're just kind of rambling. Are we speaking? And if we're emotional and we speak, then it's even more dramatic because we get caught up in the emotion of it and we don't always think of the rules of grammar and the rules of syntax and the rules of consistency in second person and third person. We're just talking, we're rambling, like I'm doing now, right? We're just rambling. So there are moments in Tanakh, and I think this is one of them. There are a few others I'll show you next week. There are moments where the emotion of the moment is caught not just by the content of what's said, but by the way in which it is said, the way in which it comes over. The lack of consistency, the repetitiveness, the lack of grammatical consistency, I think is a reflection of the fact that we're dealing with an emotional tefillah, and that emotion is reflected in the choppiness of it. And in a certain sense, when Sefer Shmuel is put together, remember, this part of the Sefer is written not by Shmuel, not by David. Who wrote this part of the Sefer? Shlomo. Say that again?
Shlomo?
No, Shlomo's not a Navi. Right? Which Navi wrote Sefer Shmuel? Shmuel wrote his first part of the Sefer, but then Shmuel died, so he couldn't have finished it.
Natan.
Natan and Gad wrote parts of it, but this part was certainly written by Natan. When the Navi sits down to write and put together, could have edited it back down to its core message and restored its syntax and its grammar and its correctness, but doing so, you lose a little bit of the emotion of it. And by preserving it in exactly this way, the syntax we'll see in Divayamin, but by preserving it in this way, you get not just the content of David's message, but also a little bit of the energy and the emotion of David's speech. He's so drawn into this expression of thanks. That's why it's so repetitive. It's poetic, but also repetitive. He says the same thing over and over and over again. How many times do I start a sentence with the word ata, with an ayin? Now. You, Hashem Tzvaot, you reveal this to your servant. Okay, therefore, ata Hashem Elokim, ata hu Elokim, ata ha'elu varech et beit avdecha. Ki ata Hashem Elokim. Who speaks like that? But in the context of the emotion, David is just pouring out his heart.
And did somebody sit there and write it when he was talking?
No, I don't think that that's necessary. But in the context of how the Nevi'im, how the Sifrei Nevi'im were written, I think it reflected or preserved the tefillah as David said it, whether David reflected it afterwards or Natan was there, who knows? I don't know the answer to that question. But I do see that emotion in this speech, which you don't see in its copy or its parallel in Divrei Yomim. There are a number of places in the Nevi'im where you see this kind of emotion. David and Yonatan, when they part company for the last time, when Shaul enters the city of and he meets Shmuel for the first time, and he meets the girls outside the city who are gazing upon him and in his beauty, there's a number of different Shmuel's final farewell speech to the people before he anoints Shaul as king. There's a few places where you find this kind of syntax, grammar, repetitive, strange quality. And I think it's all part of that same idea, that these are very emotional, dramatic moments. And so they're reflected in the, not only the content, but also the style of how they are written. So we'll look at two or three of them as Rav Hashem next week to kind of just highlight examples of this. But that was sort of where we, where I wanted to bring us to. And so I think Pasuk of Gimel is really the highlight of this distinction. All right. So
can I also ask one more thing about the difference between Aleph and Bet? So if Natan wrote the second one, Shmuel wrote the first one, is the writing pretty similar or not really?
So first of all, the separation between Shmuel and Natan is not Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet. Just to clarify that.
Shmuel
Shaul dies in Perek Chaf Hey, I believe, of Shmuel Aleph. So Shaul, the distinction between Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet is not a Jewish origin. I think, I don't know if we talked about that, but it's really Sefer Shmuel is one Sefer. Aleph and Bet's all one Sefer. The parts that were written by Shmuel are they stylistically different than Natan? A little bit. Can you see that difference? Probably not, because they probably were edited subsequently by the Anshe Knesset HaGedola. On the other hand, there are definitely places where you see the transition between what Shmuel wrote and what Natan wrote by virtue of certain chapters that are repetitive or certain chapters that are out of order. I think we talked a little bit about that a number of years ago. So there is a, as an example, David meets Goliath. David fights Goliath in the chapter. David meets Shaul, enters into the service of Shaul, becomes his armor bearer, and in Shaul and plays his harp, and he becomes his musician. In one chapter, and then in the next chapter, literally the next chapter, David goes to fight Goliath, and Shaul has absolutely no idea who he is. And the Mefarshim question, like, how could Shaul have just forgotten who Shaul ben Mizeh Anar? He said, "Who is this guy? Who is this kid? What do you mean? He's your musician. He's you just hired him." So the simplest explanation is that Shmuel wrote to a certain point, and Natan wrote the rest of the, or God wrote the rest of it. So that Chazal say that Sefer Shmuel was written by three separate authors. So that's a possibility. Be that as it may, I want to, we're going to stop here. Next week, B'ezrat Hashem, I'll start with a little bit of kind of an example or two of this kind of writing in other places in Tanakh, so you can see it. We'll spend a little bit of time on the end of this perek, and then I want to move on to perek Chet, and our next unit of study is going to take us through perek Chet, Tet, and Yud, kind of as a unit. And it's unfortunately, it's one of those moments in Sefer Shmuel where you see that it's very choppy. Like it's clearly written out of order We've had examples of it, but this is really much more of a chant. And so we kind of have to look at the whole piece of these three chapters and how they interrelate to each other. So if you feel like getting a little bit of head start and doing some homework, you're welcome to read through the next three chapters. We're going to look at them sort of in sequence.
Right.
Questions?
Yeah, Rabbi Shulman. Oh, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So I don't know whether it's just me reading into it or it's too simplistic, which is probably likely, but there seem to be parallels between Hashem's making Avraham a leader. And we talk about Avraham coming from humble roots, being an Aramean, and he promises him the land of Israel for eternity and for his, you know, his progeny. And with Hashem's promise to David,
I don't think you're overreading it. I think it's an interesting question. I would say it's subject for further analysis. I think there's probably something there. I have to think through exactly how to navigate it, where, you know, what implication it would have, but it's certainly fascinating parallel. Difference between them being that Abraham comes out of seemingly out of nowhere, and David comes out of his experiences as a warrior, his loyalty to God, his loyalty to David emerges into this role slowly, whereas Abraham kind of just appears out of nowhere and jumps on the scenes.
Right.
But certainly there is a.
I was thinking of the eternal, you know, the promise for. Right. It being eternal, and yet we've been in and out of Israel, and right. Sort of similar to.
Correct. I think I showed you those psukim last week, right? The promise of the land of Israel as achuzat olam, the meaning of the word olam there being not necessarily perpetual but right. Eternal.
Right.
Right. For sure. Okay.
Rabbi, I had one question.
Yeah.
So you used the. It was interesting you used the word emotion, saying that this is, David might have been emotional and this is a reflection of that. Maybe this is a distinction without a difference, but I looked at it as David came and approached, you know, was initially approaching Natan about, right, the base of Migdash, as you said. And instead, he gets a response and says, hey, you're about to get the throne forever, right? So there's this eternity aspect, and he was thrown off his game. And that maybe this is, you know, if you're like a little bit dumbfounded and you can't come up with the right words and you're stumbling because all of a sudden you're being rewarded something you never even thought about, which may be far in excess of building just the temple.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're at a loss for words and you're just stumbling around trying to pull it together.
For sure. And you end up, when you do that, you end up repeating yourself a lot. You end up with half sentences, jumping themes, for sure. I think we're saying the same thing. Yeah. I think the what's driving the emotion is both the magnitude of the promise that he was given and the surprise at it, considering where it was coming from, for sure. Okay, any other questions? No? Then I will adjourn for now. And I appreciate everybody's patience in listening. And Bezrat Hashem, we will continue next week.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Have a good week.
You too.
Thank you.
Stay healthy.
Thank you.
You too. All the best to you all.
Thank you.